The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and printing impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our program for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return to the March 2020 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. We've been talking about mountains this month. We're going to read an article, the name of which I'm not 100% sure I'm pronouncing correctly. Probably not, so beat me up for it. I'll give you the number at the end. You can call and complain. But as I'm going to read it, it's titled, The Many Lives of Vade Mecum. That's V-A-D-E-M-E-C-U-M. A mineral springs resort in the Soratown Mountains has seen its share of wildlife, from circus animals to wealthy flappers to Episcopalian campers. Now lion-hearted locals are fighting to preserve the property. Written by Mark Essig. There's an old-timey photograph here at the top. It says Vade Mecum Springs Hotel, Vade Mecum, North Carolina. There's a really old Model T there, or something in front. It's open on the sides. It looks like it has a hard top, but it's all open on the sides. And there's those big old headlights in the front, and the wheels look like they're light gray in color. I suppose they're supposed to be white, but they're on a little dirt pathway in front of the hotel, and there's about, well, I can't tell you how many. As far as I can see behind it, they're all lined up. The more cars, the one immediately behind is a convertible. And on the second level of the hotel, which is all white, standing behind a white fence, are all sorts of people. I mean, it's just jammed there. They're all dressed up. All the men have suits on and white shirts and ties and hats, you can tell. And then there's a man and a woman, or two men down in front. They're probably chauffeurs standing behind the first car. John Sparks, a circus owner and the operator of Vade Mecum, a grand mineral springs resort in Stokes County, died in 1903 of injuries suffered in a lion attack. A lot has happened on his hilltop property since then, but when you talk to locals today about Vade Mecum, you will hear the tale about the lion. That fact says something about our fascination with circuses and strange history, of course, but it also reveals the power of stories to bind people to a place and to inspire them to fight like hell to preserve it. Sparks ran a three railroad car circus that toured the South in the 1890s. During a swing through North Carolina, the Pennsylvania native formed a partnership with businessmen from Winston-Salem and opened a resort that soon attracted the Piedmont elite. There's no more beautiful, picturesque spot on the globe than Vade Mecum Springs, one early visitor insisted. That surely was an exaggeration, but the resort had much to recommend it. Two large hotels dominated the grounds, while those seeking privacy could rent one of the 20 homes on Cottage Hill. Just downslope was Diamond Lake, where the resort offered boating, swimming, and, for the adventurous, a thrilling toboggan plunge. Burrow parties were arranged for those who wished to ride to the top of nearby Moore's Knob, now part of Hanging Rock State Park. The smaller of the resort's two hotels, graced with a fine ballroom, was favored by the Young and Giddy, a newspaper reported, while the larger housed older and sick people. That latter group came for the water. At the time, North Carolina was home to a couple dozen mineral springs resorts, all touting their healing properties. The resort's curious name was itself a testimonial to the water, Vade Mecum, Latin for go with me. There was once a common term for a handbook, the physician's Vade Mecum, for instance, small enough to be carried in a pocket. The phrase often referred to items carried at all times, money, medication, and therefore came to be mean, rather, indispensable. That's what Sparks had in mind. A resort brochure claimed that to thousands, this water is indispensable. The water was bottled and shipped across the South. Vitamakum water continues to make its way into the hearts and homes of the dyspeptic population of Charlotte, according to a 1901 Charlotte Daily Observer ad. But many preferred to follow the water to its source, a creekside spring on the resort grounds. Advertisements claimed that the water was the ideal combination of tonic, laxative, diuretic, blood purifier, and restorative nervine, and offered a testimonial from a minister describing the water as a marvelous manifestation of the divine love providing for the relief of human suffering. The ads make clear that the circus and mineral water businesses had at least one thing in common. Both required extravagant puffery, especially considering that Vadimakum's sulfur-tinged water would gag a goat, according to Thad Woodward, who once tried it. More on him later. Sparks, though, genuinely loved the place. He built himself a house at Vadimakum and announced plans to breed and train circus animals there. To get that project started, Sparks had two young lions shipped to the property. He was petting one of them when it badly mauled his arm. A few days later, on January 28, 1903, he died of an infection. Sparks was buried in Pennsylvania, and his lions were shipped back to the circus, but the resort and the legend survived. One afternoon in 2013, Debbie Vaden heard a rumble that sounded like bulldozers at Vadimakum. They were logging the property, she says, just clear-cutting some areas. After a career as a nurse in San Diego, Vaden had returned home to Stokes County to tend her family's land. Vadimakum, in fact, had once been part of that family land. Her great-grandfather had sold the property to Sparks and his partners. Vaden knew the history intimately. After Sparks' death, the resort thrived for more than a decade, but it faded after a 1920 fire destroyed one of the two hotel buildings. The Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina took over the property in the 1930s, preserving the surviving hotel and eventually building a chapel, gym, and cabins for campers. In the 1980s, North Carolina State University's 4-H program assumed control with help from Sertoma clubs. The camps had been careful stewards of the property, which made the logging all the more surprising. Vaden soon learned that North Carolina State had sold the cleared timber and shuttered the 4-H camp. The property would be sold. She called friends and neighbors, and together they wrote emails and pressured politicians. They met with almost immediate success. In the summer of 2014, the state legislature halted the property sale and transferred the land and its historic buildings to nearby Hanging Rock State Park. Vadimakum was saved. Vaden and her colleagues rejoiced. Little did they know the struggle was only beginning. I know they get frustrated at how slow we've been to get things going, says Carl Tingley, deputy director for the North Carolina Division of Parks and Recreation. Well, yes, they do. They, refers to Vaden and other members of the Friends of Soratown Mountains, the volunteer group that supports Hanging Rock and Pilot Mountain State Parks. They're disappointed that in the nearly 6 years since North Carolina State Parks took over Vadimakum, the agency hasn't been able to do much to improve the property. The volunteers, meanwhile, have staged open houses, raised money, hired caretakers, and arranged for mold remediation, all in a somewhat frantic effort to stave off the rot that afflicts unoccupied buildings. The park system does face a difficult task. In Vadimakum, they had inherited both a wonderful resource and an enormous headache. Glorious, irreplaceable structures in dire need of expensive renovations. The gym, built by the Episcopalians in the early 1930s, is a soaring barn of a structure with high ceilings, a giant fireplace, and big gaps in the siding. The three-story resort hotel, built in 1902, is clad in white clapboard, with porches stretching the length of the first two floors. Inside, beadboard walls and ceilings need a new coat of paint. But the stench of mold, the legacy of a burst sprinkler pipe, is clear evidence of the pricey renovations that await. The North Carolina Division of Parks and Recreation plans to turn Vadimacum into an event center and campus that will host music festivals, conferences, and weddings. But before the money starts rolling into the local economy, millions will be spent to update the buildings and grounds. The master plan for Vadimacum includes a first phase projected at $4.6 million. The project has been awarded $2.1 million in Connect North Carolina bond funds, and it may get another $1 million in the 2020 state budget. Design work is expected to start soon. The whole tourism industry at the turn of the 20th century is represented here, and not very much of that has survived anywhere else, Tingley says. It's an extremely valuable property, but it's an expensive restoration. Thad Woodward, who camped at Vadimacum during the Episcopal years, has returned to the property as head of the North Carolina Bankers Association to donate money and time. It should be noted that once, only once, he tasted the water. Woodward understands state politics well enough to be realistic. Despite the main building's beauty, he frets over all the work it still needs. While you wait for the politicians to give the money, he says, it will fall in. It's clear, though, that Woodward won't let that happen. When he starts talking about his time as a camper, his face lights up with a grin, and in a lovely, scratchy bass, he launches into the Macomb Cannonball, a song about the camp station wagon. She's a mighty, purty engine. Hear all them campers squall, riding down the highway in the Macomb Cannonball. Summer camps inspire lasting devotion. Janice Henderson Hunsucker, now an art teacher at North Stokes High School, fell in love with Vadimacum while working as a 4-H counselor. I came from a divorced family, and I really wanted to belong, she says. When I came here, I felt that sense of belonging. Summer camps are like tribes. Vadim feels that tribal pull as well, not for summer camp, but for her ancestral land and the tales she heard growing up. My grandparents told stories about how they would hear the elephants trumpeting and the lions roar, she recalls. Whether that's really true, I don't know for sure. Truth be told, it's probably not. Steve Shelton, a retired band director and Vadimacum's unofficial historian, has dug through the newspaper archives and found no evidence that circus animals other than those fatal lions ever arrived at the resort. But that doesn't stop the stories. It's just the kind of thing you want to believe, he says. When Henderson Hunsucker was a 4-H camp counselor, she transformed the story into a scary campfire tale. We'd tell the kids, there's the ghost of a lion. You'd better not sneak out of that cabin, because the lion's going to come and eat you. And the children would scream. She remembers fondly those rowdy, carefree camp days as she walks the empty trails that snake around the property. When I'm here, I hear the echoes of children playing, she says. It's too quiet now. Someday, somehow, the money will come together, she believes. The old hotel will be renovated and the children will return to Vadimacum. And at nights, when they burrow into their sleeping bags and drift off to sleep, they might just hear the roar of a lion. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. And now, Rough Riders. The ancient Juharez aren't the biggest mountains in North Carolina, but for off-road ramblers and rugged 4x4s, they're a muddy mess of fun. These drivers know just how tough and how fragile the landscape really is. Photo here of the side of a Jeep Unlimited. It says, steep and rocky hills make the southern part of Juharez National Forest ideal terrain for four-wheeling. The Baden Lake OHV Trail Complex includes six trailheads offering access to 16 miles of hair-raising maneuvers. This photo, shot from the side and low down of a Jeep apparently going over a really rough section, the front right tire is biting into the dirt at the top of a rock, I think, and the left tire is midair, as we see underneath. I'm not surprised at what I see on the next page. Anytime you go four-wheeling, you have the risk of getting stuck or something broken. And we see a picture here of a long cable being extended from one vehicle to another. And the caption says, after three failed attempts to scale Rocky Scrambler Hill, a stuck Toyota FJ Cruiser gets pulled back to solid ground. A Jeep Republican, the opposite page, navigates Jason's Trail, known for its long and deep mud holes. I would not want to be in that mud hole. This vehicle is tipped over at about a 30-degree angle, probably, 30 to 35 degrees. I cannot see the right side of the vehicle, which is on the left as we see it. The left side of the vehicle on our right has the full tire spinning around. The right tire is simply gone in that mud hole. Tommy Gray stands at the top of Scrambler Hill, having just mastered a precarious challenge. Minutes before, he'd maneuvered up the steep, rocky climb in his Jeep Wrangler JKU. And now he's looking down on a fellow driver who's having less luck. A Toyota FJ Cruiser is surrendered to the hill, stuck at an angle so deep that the view from the windshield reveals only sky and tree limbs. The vehicle skews to the right, its right rear tire having slipped off the trail. If the driver makes the wrong move, the cruiser could flip. Gray rests his hands on his hips and cocks his head. Bit of a pickle, he says. Come across the scene anywhere else, and you'd see flashing lights and first responders. Come across it during a weekend of off-roading in the Yuhari Mountains, and the most alarm you'll hear is from Gray, who casually understates the predicament. Even the cruiser's driver and his passengers seem more curious than concerned. It's hard to pity this group for getting into such messes. After all, the 15 drivers and their passengers signed up for this. They drove to the Yuharis on roads, perfectly paved roads, to take their vehicles, expensive vehicles, onto forest trails that thread narrowly between trees and to traverse boulders and hills that seem more like obstructions than obstacles. It's also hard to pity a group that's having so much fun, even in a pickle. In fact, figuring out how to unpickle a situation seems to be the point. One might guess that the best way to get unstuck on a trail would be to slam on the gas and hope for the best, but that's exactly the move that could lead to an even more stuck vehicle. The mood here is more refined than that, and the proposed solutions turn this trail into a physics classroom. A certain weight, throttle input, and angle can result in overcoming the same obstacle every time. Make a mistake, and the fault is in your math. The solution will be in your math, too. Another member of the group, Izzy Sanchez, walks alongside the trail to alert drivers to obstacles they can't see and to execute strategies to free vehicles from such perilous pickles. Sanchez is a mechanical engineer from Charlotte, as well as vice president of the International Four-Wheel Drive Trainers Association. He approaches off-roading with a calm presence and an analytical mind. For the cruiser, Sanchez decides to use a winch, a synthetic rope that extends from the front bumper of a carefully placed Jeep Wrangler YJ at the base of the hill to the rear bumper of the cruiser to slowly pull it out inch by inch until it gains traction. When all four wheels find solid ground, the cruiser retreats to the bottom of the hill again. Its driver, Joe Estes, asks if he can attempt to scale Scrambler Hill a fourth time. Sanchez smiles, shakes his head, no, and directs Estes to a smoother and less steep bypass that rejoins the trail and the group at the top. If you don't get pulled out of something, you're not trying hard enough, Estes says with a shrug and a laugh. The other drivers and their passengers, who stopped to help Estes out of his predicament, return to their vehicles to resume the ride. Their speeds rarely surpass 5 miles an hour, but adrenaline still spikes. Vehicles maneuver so closely between trees and the mud on their fenders transfers to the tree bark. Ahead, there's always something, a rock scramble, a steep hill, and trees, so many trees. Attention remains sharp. How wide is that opening? How much clearance is underneath? Uari's off-roading isn't so much for daredevils as it is for tacticians. It's three-dimensional Tetris with thousands of dollars, sometimes more than $100,000 at stake. More than that, it's a hell of a ride. Think of off-roading, and you'll likely conjure images of a Jeep commercial, tires spinning, vehicles blasting through mud, and nearby woodland creatures scampering off in fear. That's the problem. Too many people think off-roading is like a Jeep commercial. That style of driving hurts the land and contributes to erosion. It's the reason public parks are closing their off-roading trails. The Uaris are no strangers to erosion. They're among the oldest mountains in North America. Once ancient volcanic peaks rising 20,000 feet, taller than today's Rocky Mountains. But river erosion wore down those peaks, and now they're only about 1,000 feet at their tallest, just enough to make this landscape of rivers, lakes, and trails an off-roading playground. As more off-roading trails close to full-size vehicles elsewhere, drivers have come to the Uaris for some of the best terrain on the East Coast. But the relationship between off-roaders and the Uaris has been fraught. For years, some drivers would improvise maneuvers that scarred the land. Can't tackle an obstacle? Just wheel around it and make your own trail. Stuck? Gun the accelerator and let your tires spin. Got trash? Toss it. Soon, narrow trails grew into dirt highways dotted with litter. The thing is, the Uaris hold sacred land filled with the history of the Catawba tribe. When rule breakers left broken arrowheads and pottery in their tracks, a movement grew. Closed the trails, some said. Then a counter movement responded. Off-roading doesn't have to be this way. At the center of the debate is Michael Spisak. As district ranger at Uhari National Forest, he consults with the North Carolina Historic Preservation Office, the Catawba Tribe, and off-roading groups to keep the forest open for pleasure seekers while ensuring that the trails have minimal impact on cultural resources. The Uhari has some of the highest density archaeology in the eastern U.S., Spisak says. It's pretty common to go anywhere and find some kind of artifact. The trails that the off-roaders use, Spisak says, began in the 1960s as logging roads built without regard for the archaeological importance of the land. Now, scientists survey the land and locate and protect artifacts, and they adjust trails when necessary. Kodak Rock Trail, a segment of Rocky Mountain Loop Trail, closed permanently after land surveys revealed that it came too close to Native American hunting points and cooking tools. Most off-roading groups understand their legal and ethical responsibilities to protect the lands by success, and they know what will happen to the trails if they don't. In fact, those groups have become partners with the Forest Service in its conservation efforts. The drivers on today's ride, led by members of the Four Wheel Drive Association and other groups, including Overland Experts, which trains military and humanitarian forces, are among those partners. The ride is affiliated with the larger American Adventurist Appalachian Rendezvous, a weekend event with a geography misnomer that invites enthusiasts to the Uaris to kayak, mountain bike, and off-road in ways that respect the land. Other allies include local clubs that host monthly work days, picking up litter and installing guardrails that force vehicles to stay on the trails. A positive peer pressure has emerged, with experienced drivers unafraid to tell irresponsible newbies to cut it out. If we're responsibly taking care of our trails, then groups who aren't in favor of off-roading will have nothing to complain about, says Bo Rosa, president of the Triad Jeep Club. We're fighting the image that we're people who are out here spinning tires and flying through mud. Earlier in the day, before Tommy Gray and the others hit the trail, before the pickle, they stood on the forest shade listening to Mike Morrison of Overland Experts deliver a safety briefing. This is a very tight, narrow trail system. Do not stand between a vehicle and a hard point, Morrison says. Watch where you step. There are timber rattlers out there, and they will most likely leave you alone. The group listened with casual nods, all except for this rider, whose eyes widened at the words, most likely. Standing near Gray was Stephen Hellowell, a 29-year-old from Smithfield, who comes to the Uaris regularly after long work weeks as a project engineer. Beside him was his good friend John Carlisle, who, at 29, uses off-roading as a stress reliever after his shifts as a Wake County Sheriff's deputy. More than the thrill and more than the challenge, off-roaders say they seek an escape. They find camaraderie in connecting with their fellow outdoor enthusiasts who flee sterile office environments for a rock scramble in the mountains. Helliwell and Carlisle met while off-roading in the Ujarias 7 years ago, and they've become more like brothers than friends because of the hours they've spent together out here. When you get to the top of the hill, you hang out, talk about life, grill up some lunch, Carlisle says, his words fading into a smile. At the El Dorado Outpost, the spot where off-roaders pick up supplies and breakfast before a ride, a driver who walks in alone often leaves with a group of new friends. In the forest, there's an instant camaraderie and an egalitarian vibe that's hard to find elsewhere. Out here, CEOs don't sit any higher than the guy who flips burgers during the week, Helliwell says. And if something happens to a vehicle, then the two of them will both be under the Jeep together fixing it. At the end of the day, after about 3 hours of steep hills, mud pits, and several more pickles, the 15 vehicles return to the spot where they first gathered. They wear mud-like badges, but otherwise are unscathed. Drivers prepare for the ride home by reinflating tires. They all linger for a while, reminiscing about the day's big obstacles, before it's back to those perfectly paved roads. The bug bites hard, Helliwell says of the off-roading in the Ujarias. The first time is terrifying, and you're beating the crap out of a vehicle that you're still making payments on. But when you're driving home, you realize you didn't bust it up. You want to go back and do it again. There's one little sidebar in here called Jeep sighting. People claim to have seen it on the trails. Photos online suggest that it exists, but if you're hoping to catch a glimpse of the Jeep Ujarias edition yourself, well, you may as well go on a hunt for Bigfoot. Around the time of the first Jeep Jamboree USA in the Ujarias National Forest, enthusiast Ivan Stonke and some friends discussed creating a special edition Jeep named after that special place. Stonke, who at the time worked at Hendrick Auto Mall Concord Hills, designed and built the vehicle himself. He installed a suspension system with two hydraulic bumper stops to allow the Jeep to scramble over the Ujarias' rugged terrain, and high-clearance fender flares and bumpers to handle tree and rock contour while protecting the rest of the vehicle, he says. A winch and some all-terrain tires were the finishing touches. Unfortunately, due to internal changes at the dealership, the Ujarias Edition project was shelved, and Stonke only ever built the one. He isn't sure who owns this elusive Jeep right now, but if you head into the wilds of the Ujarias, don't rule out a sighting. Rumor has it that it's still in the area, if you know where to look. Well, that's about all the time we have for this week's edition of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973, and the contents of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is also readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.